Then the disciples returned home, but Mary stood outside the tomb weeping. As she wept, she bent down to look in the tomb, and she saw two angels sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head, the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken my Lord away, and I do not know where they've laid him." As she turned, she saw Jesus standing there, but she did not know that that was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." As she turned, she said in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for as yet I have not ascended to my Father. But go, tell my brothers, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord."
It's been a busy week here at St. Luke's, and our music team has just done a magnificent job with special services. Friday night, just gorgeous music, and of course today we're all just appreciative of the work that they've done, and I would ask you to join me in thanking them for all that they've been doing this week and this morning. They'll be hustling in just a few minutes to go from here to Robertson Chapel to set up for the service over there, so we're deeply appreciative. My fourth Easter Sunday at St. Luke's, and I continue to just stand here and go, wow, wow, all of the folks who come on this glorious morning, and I'm just really glad you're here and to welcome you today. Warren Wiersbe, very gifted author and pastor and an IU grad. Last service, I said that with a look of surprise. Some IU people kind of got on me for that. I don't mean to sound surprised that an IU grad would be a gifted pastor, but just kind of came out that way. He tells about getting a letter from somebody one time who said, "Can you help me? Our pastor on Easter Sunday said Jesus didn't really die on the cross, that he just swooned there and the disciples nurtured him back to health. What do you think?" Sincerely, bewildered. So he wrote back to this person and said, "Dear Bewildered, beat your preacher with a cat of nine tails with 39 heavy strokes. Nail him to a cross. Hang him in the sun for 3 hours. Run a spear through his heart. Embalm him. Put him in an airless tomb for 36 hours and see what happens." Well, one thing I can promise you about the sermon today, I'm not going to suggest that Jesus just swooned on the cross. But if you're somebody who's had a hard time believing in the story of the resurrection, the evidence of Easter, that a dead Jesus was raised to life, then I want you to know that's understandable. And it's even affirmed in the Bible. Have you ever thought about how much the Easter stories give attention to doubt? Only one person believed on the evidence of an empty tomb, as we heard Gustana share a moment ago. That was John the disciple. The empty tomb for Mary was just a cause for further grief because she thought somebody stole the body. Peter walked away from the empty tomb just kind of confused, not knowing what to make of it. In the Gospels of Mark and Luke, when the women go and tell the disciples Christ is risen, they don't believe them. And the Gospel of Matthew, when the disciples experienced the risen Lord, he took them to a hill, he ascended from them. Here's how the gospel ends, most amazing ending. They worshiped, but some doubted. Last words of the gospel, some doubted. Why does the Bible go to great length to include doubt in the Easter story? I believe that there are a couple of reasons. One is so that people who have a hard time believing in this story can find their place in it. They can relate to this story. I believe doubt is included to say to doubters everywhere, you're understood. But I believe it's also included to say that the purpose of this story is not to prove the resurrection. That's not the purpose of it. If the resurrection is something that requires evidence, it will no longer require faith. And ultimately, this is a faith story. People are invited to believe something, or at least hold the possibility of believing something. The resurrection does not become real until people have encountered the risen Christ. So we, like the disciples of Jesus, are invited in this story to follow along and see if we might discover with the same validity today as they discovered then that Christ is alive. How does that happen? How do we really make that discovery? The title of the message today is The Resurrection in 3D. Sometimes I wonder if we would love to have that, a three-dimensional resurrection that we can analyze it, view it, get our hands on it, and believe it. But in actuality, there's something better, and that's to experience and encounter a life-changing risen Lord. What are the conditions that make that possible? I want to look at the conditions in the Easter story, some of the simple conditions that allowed people to experience the risen Christ. And each of these three condition words will begin, as you might have guessed by now, with the letter D. The first D stands for darkness. That's the first condition we read in the Easter story. Mary went to the tomb, discovered it empty while it was still dark. Now, that's in the Gospel of John, which we heard this morning. Matthew, Mark, and Luke disagree. They say, no, the sun was up. It was already light. Why does John say it was dark? Did he forget to set his clock for Eastern or daylight savings time? Is that the problem? No. You see, John is not giving a reference to the time of day. When he says it's dark, he means something different. John uses darkness a lot in his gospel. It's an important symbol. When Nicodemus went to see Jesus, but he didn't want other people to know he was talking with Jesus, he went by night when it was dark. When the disciples were out in a boat on the Sea of Galilee and they experienced Jesus walking on water, they did so in the midst of fearing for their lives. It was at night. When Judas betrayed Jesus at the Last Supper, he ran away from the table, and it says, and it was night. He went into the darkness. Darkness in the Gospel of John hints at a condition in which God is absent. Have you ever been in a dark place? Have you ever been in a place where it feels like God is not around, God is not with you in that space? So think about the message that John is sending when he begins the Easter story and says that Mary went, while it was still dark, to a tomb and found it was empty. John is telling us God works at night. God works in the dark. By the time it's light, that simply means we're getting a chance to see what God has already been doing. Darkness does not mean God is absent. It just means we have yet to see what God is up to. You might recognize the name Bill Wilson, better known as Bill W., one of the founders of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Did you know that the psychiatrist Carl Jung and the philosopher William James both had a big influence on the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous? This is a picture. Go back to Carl Jung. Let people see Carl Jung. He was treating an American businessman named Roland Hazard for severe alcoholism. And the person really appreciated Jung's counsel and treatment and advice, but he relapsed in a bad way, went back to Switzerland, and he said, "I just don't know what to do." And Carl Jung finally said to him, "I don't either. There's no hope for you." Now talk about darkness. Imagine your doctor saying, "No hope for you." "Except," said Carl Jung, "that you might have a spiritual conversion. The only thing I've seen people get through what you're going through is a spiritual conversion." So Roland Hazard came back to the United States, got involved in a Christian fellowship started by a pastor named Samuel Shoemaker. It was called the Oxford Group. And a big part of their philosophy, not only was their Christian faith, but the philosophy of William James, who said powerful spiritual transformations come out of calamity. They come out of times of hopelessness and darkness. Roland Hazard ends up having a spiritual conversion, and he breaks free of his addiction to alcohol. He goes and he shares what happened in his life with a good friend of his, and that friend has the same experience, breaks free. That friend was a drinking buddy of Bill W., Bill Wilson. Now, Bill Wilson was a committed atheist. It was really sad news to him when his friend told him he had got religion. Bill W. is like, oh, I've lost another friend. It's bad enough you won't drink with me, but you're going to try to put religion on me? Man, forget about it. But he kept talking with him, sharing his faith with him. And one day, Bill W.'s life got so dark, he said, "I'll try anything." He went to a service with his friend, and he invited Jesus Christ into his life. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. The next day, he checked himself into a hospital for treatment. Now, back then, a treatment that was used for severe alcoholics was a treatment called something they would give them called belladonna's, potent mixture of very strong narcotic drugs that would make you hallucinate. In that condition, Bill Wilson said he had a hot flash. Well, no surprise, right? The room went completely white. And Jesus Christ stepped into the room with him as real as any person could. Now, if you were talking to Bill Wilson the next day, what would you say to him? "Bill, it never happened. You were on drugs. Your body's trying to get off alcohol. Quit this foolishness and stick with your treatment. It's up to you, buddy." But his doctor didn't say that. His doctor had previously told Bill W. what Carl Jung told Roland Hazard. He had said to him, "There's no hope for you without the possibility of some kind of spiritual transformation." So after that day, here's what Bill W.'s doctor did say. "Something has happened to you, and I don't understand it, but you'd better hang on to it because anything is better than the way you were." Isn't that a great statement? Anything is better than the way you were. Bill Wilson never drank again. He later wrote a letter to Carl Jung, and he said, "I want you to understand what you told a person many years ago and what a doctor told me is the foundation. It's the very first step of AA, and I give you the credit, because people have to understand that life is hopeless without a higher power. That's where it begins. What was he saying? In deep darkness is where we can discover the power of God the best. Now, I'm not trying to offer this like it's some kind of simplistic penicillin. In fact, Bill Wilson's friend who brought him to faith ended up going back to alcohol again. There's always room for doubt. There's always room for casting it aside and saying, you see, there's somebody for whom it didn't work. But what about the possibility of it working? What about the possibility that in the darkness of your life, that it is not a place where God is absent, but God is very, very present in that place? What does that mean for you? That maybe that could be a place in your life where God's power can be opened up to you. Maybe today you're in a dark place of some kind of sin, some kind of behavior, and you're running empty on your own power to make a change. And you feel like God has left you to your own devices. Maybe just change and say, God, I'm going to choose to believe you're in this place with me. Maybe you're in a place of grief. Maybe you're in a place of despair. What would happen if you say, maybe, God, this darkness is an opportunity in my life. I want to be open to that. The next condition, the next D, stands for devotion. Mary went to the tomb of Jesus to simply carry out a religious rite, to embalm his body, to put burial spices on Jesus. They didn't have time to do that when he was buried because of the Sabbath. Now, she did not go to the tomb that morning expecting to find anything, right? Except a body. She didn't go with an excited, anticipating heart. She was probably going with perhaps a sense of devotion, carrying out one last act of love. And yet, because she put herself in that position, look what happened. Have you ever found yourself carrying out some kind of religious devotion, but your heart really isn't in it? I mean, have you ever gone to church when you didn't really want to be there? I mean, is there anybody here this morning who... Don't raise a hand. I mean, sometimes life's like that, isn't it? Our heart isn't always in it. We don't feel like it. This is the wonderful good news of Easter. You don't have to believe it to experience it. Your heart doesn't have to anticipate the power of resurrection for it to become real. But it is important to at least put ourselves in position. I mean, that's what we're doing here in the Methodist Church today. A long time ago, a man named John Wesley, a priest in the Church of England, got involved with a Moravian society meeting. He would write in his journal, "I went very unwillingly to this meeting. At the meeting, somebody was reading Martin Luther's preface to the letter to the Romans." Has anybody here ever read Martin Luther's preface to the Romans? Folks, reading the phone book would be more interesting. This is not a Tom Clancy novel. It is certainly not 50 Shades of Grey. Snoozer material. And yet, John Wesley wrote, while it was being read, "I felt my heart strangely warmed. I knew that Christ had died for my sins, even mine," he said. In a moment when he went unwillingly, the truth of something he had been preaching for years finally became true in his heart. And out of that started the Methodist movement. That's why we're sitting here today in a Methodist church. Are you needing a spiritual breakthrough this morning? Are you looking to get in a new place spiritually in your life? Has your faith grown cold? Instead of focusing on whether or not you believe, instead of focusing on your faith at all, make that unimportant. Don't worry about whether or not you believe a thing. Just focus on putting yourself in position. maybe this is a good day to say, you know what? I'm going to start coming to worship again. I'm going to make that a pattern in my life. I don't know that I believe it. I know my heart's not in it, but you know what? I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it for a while. I'm going to see what happens. Maybe get back into a habit of prayer. Have you ever found when you get discouraged in life, taking time to pray is about the last thing you're interested in doing? Take time for devotion and meditation. Just put yourself in position. That's what Mary did. She just carried out a devotion, and lo and behold, look what happened. And then the last condition, the last D, stands for difference. When people do experience the risen Christ, they don't go back to life the way it was. They don't just go back home and have a meal and get ready for work the next day. They are changed. They become part of that difference-making mission in the world. And as people let God use them to make a difference in the world, they discover even more the power of God at work. It's interesting to me that if God's purpose was to make sure every person who ever lived knew the truth of the resurrection, surely God would go about it a different way, wouldn't you think? I mean, wouldn't God break through in some dramatic fashion in every person's life to say, now you get it, now you see it? I mean, wouldn't you think that'd work? Instead, God announces that kind of hope through people. God must think that the most convicting evidence of a risen Savior is the difference it makes in somebody's life. That the thing that's going to hook me is when I see another person in a changed form going, what happened to them? Maybe I need that. Brennan Manning is known as a very gifted author and speaker. Perhaps his most famous book was The Ragamuffin Gospel, but his birth name was Richard Manning. When he was 18, he went to fight in the Korean War. He was in a foxhole with his buddy Ray Brennan, and a hand grenade was lobbed into the foxhole. They were sharing a candy bar. Ray saw the grenade, he tossed the wrapper aside, and he laid down on the hand grenade. His stomach absorbed the full explosion. He looked up at Richard, and he winked at him and died. Richard Manning didn't even have a scratch on him because of what his friend did. But when he got out of the army and he came back to the United States, the first thing he did was to go to the courthouse and change his legal name to Brennan Manning. He did not want to live another day without something to remind him that the reason he's alive is somebody loved him enough to die for him. He wanted to make sure he was challenged with this thought to live every day worthy of the sacrifice that had been made for him. This is the significance of the Christian life. When we can look at a cross and understand that God loves us so much, He would give His Son for us. He would give that life for us. But the power of the cross is not just because of sacrifice. It's because of resurrection. You see, because that one who died rose again, it shows the triumph of sacrificial love. It validates the cross. It says that God's way of giving self away is what ultimately wins out in the world. I'm so proud of our church here at St. Luke's for what's been going on in this season of Lent, the way we've been giving ourselves away. When we started our Lent series one morning, I talked about an inner city ministry called Achieve International. They help some of the most at-risk teenagers to stay in school and get an education. It's the ministry itself is located in one of the toughest areas of Indianapolis. You see them working here at the church because to raise some money. They will come about once a month and do work around our property. And these are recent pictures of them working here at St. Luke's. I shared that morning that their biggest need right now is tutors. And we've had a number of people volunteer to go into this rough part of the city and to help tutor these kids. Talk about making a difference. During this season of Lent, St. Luke's has opened a food pantry at 71st and Michigan Road. We celebrated the grand opening just a few weeks ago, as you see. We're already serving more than we expected to. The other day, they had 49 families come in, 21 within the first hour. What a difference this is making. And then we've had lots of Lent groups throughout the season doing projects all around the city. But what really excites me is not just the difference that we make out in the world, it's the difference that God makes in our lives when we do it. I want to close with this story about David Blazing Wimmer. David and his mom and dad started coming to St. Luke's when we began the 1045 service last year. His dad is in the religion department of Lilly Endowment. He's a United Methodist pastor. And David's mother, Jan, is an educator and lawyer whose father was a Methodist pastor, in fact, was a one-time assistant to the bishop. David was born a twin, but his sister died shortly after birth. In fact, our bishop, Mike Coyner, was their superintendent at the time, and he performed the funeral. David went through a number of surgeries, and he's a medical miracle to be alive today. Through a lot of perceptions he hears from other people, perceptions validated by his own experience, he's had a thought that churches are full of hypocrites and a lot of judgment, constantly talking about people who don't fit in and shouldn't be welcome. So he didn't come to St. Luke's with mom and dad as the biggest believer in church. But they were in this small group recently, and they joined other groups in putting on an Easter egg hunt at a nearby apartment complex. He offered some of his own stuffed animals, which is a very important collection of his, very, very important in his life. He offered them as prizes that day. He was willing to give them away. It was such a meaningful experience that the next day, he wrote a school paper about it. He gave me permission to share some of it with you. For my community service project, I went to Creekwood Apartments in Northwest Indianapolis to help my church, St. Luke's, run an Easter egg hunt for the kids in the apartments. The apartments are government subsidized, so the kids that we helped don't have a lot of money. Because we needed prizes and gifts for the children who would participate, I brought and donated some of my stuffed animals that I didn't need anymore. When I gave my animals away to the kids that they won in bingo, I asked them to take good care of my old friends. At the end of our time together, we made a circle and every kid got a prize to make sure that all the kids got one. It made me so happy to know that every kid got a prize and no one was left out. I feel really good about doing this. I feel like I helped make this day special so kids and their families could make their early Easter special. I feel like I made a difference in the lives of these kids and I feel good about it. I'm glad to be involved in this, and the experience has made me remember that even though Christianity has sometimes done bad things in history, it does more good than bad. It made me realize that all the evil in the world, and believe me, I've heard about the evil done to people in these apartments, that good people help to ease that pain and help them to think the world is a better place. After we got home, I told my mom, of all the things you've taken me to at church, I like this one the best. I remember an old phrase that I try to live by: if you do good for others, they'll do good in return. What that means is that if I do good for people, they may do good things for others and for you in the future. I really like this job the best. You know, Christ calls us not only to be a difference in the world, but when we become a part of that mission, Christ makes a difference in us. Why is this day maybe important for you? To know that there's hope in darkness? To know that by putting yourself in a position of devotion, that reality might break through? to let your life be used to make a difference? Oh, let it be, Easter people. Oh, let it be. Let's stand as we join together.